accession number 28361, Reel 55.
General Julian Thompson, Reel 55. You were saying you had Corporal Dean as your bodyguard.
Yeah.
As part of the BV crew.
Yeah, sure.
You normally fed with them.
Yes. I mean, my daily routine, when there wasn't a battle on, was where I'd be out all day.
Shall we start on the first thing? You said that you always insisted on getting your night's sleep.
Yep, okay, let's start in the morning.
So, what time would you be expecting to wake up and be woken?
I'd wake up at stand two, which was around first light, which was about 6:30, because it's the winter.
Yep.
And I would.
So 6:30 River Valley.
6:30 River Valley. I'd get up and I'd go along to the CP, sort of poke my nose in, see what was going on. Then I'd wander back if there was nothing happening, and by which time one of my wagon crew had brewed up breakfast, and we were living on Arctic rations there, which were.
Just dehydrated?
It was dehydrated. The only disadvantage is you need water to reconstitute it. Mm. But I would have, and you get a very good breakfast in Arctic rations. You get a bag of oatmeal, which is already mixed with dried milk, and all you have to do is pour boiling water into it.
With porridge.
And that gives you porridge. And then you put lots of sugar into it as well, which is actually in there already. So you get a heartening meal of hot porridge. Mm. So I'd have that. And a cup of tea, and that to be breakfast, and perhaps a couple of biscuits with jam on or something. And then I'd go back to the CP, look at the sort of sit reps that had come in, see what had been happening in the night, have a chat with the BM, talk about what we were going to do today. I mean, we're talking now about a period where we're doing a lot of patrolling. There's no actual big battle going on, but we're working up to a battle, working up to a big move. And I would then get in my helicopter and go off and see units. Now, if they were in, had they moved forward, and I'll come back to that in a minute, but if they were forward in their positions, I probably couldn't get further forward than the forward company, and sometimes not to them in daylight, because a lot of them were on in positions that were pretty exposed by day. But I'd certainly get to the CO. I'd then perhaps do my own recces, like go onto high ground and looking at enemy positions. And I'd take my own recce party with me. I used to travel with my gunner, usually with my sapper, usually being flown by my light helicopter squadron commander. So I had
command group.
My command group with me all the time.
Now, in a way, that's disadvantageous, because if anything had happened to that helicopter, you would have decapitated the command structure at brigade level.
I mean, if we'd had the luxury of two or three lynxes, I would have spread them around. We didn't.
Mm. So you normally went by your personal helicopter was a lynx, usually?
No, we didn't have lynxes.
You didn't?
No, we had a scout. So I could only take, it was flown by my.
You could only take four then?
You could only take four.
Cram them in.
You could actually probably get three in the back at a pinch. We took the seats out of the back, so you'd get one in the front, and usually then we'd have a co pilot anyway.
Yes.
Because it was better to have two pilots. So usually there were two pilots in the front and three of us sitting in the back.
So the co-pilot, he'd be the map reader normally, wouldn't he, and spotter?
He'd be map reading and spotting, and the other chap would be flying it and spotting, and everyone else would be looking out like mad too, because you'd be looking for fighters all the time.
Yes.
You know, the eyes were out all the time.
Yeah.
And you were flying very low, I mean so low that you were actually having to lift over the sheep fences.
Nap of the earth.
The nap of the earth flying. Absolute nap of the earth flying. So
When you went to a battalion headquarters or down to a company headquarters, what was it you were looking for?
I was looking to see how people were to begin with, what their state was. Were they, you know, suffering from cold? What chat to them, find out what their state of mind was. And just generally talk to them about things, and you know what they've been doing and what they've been up to. And getting around took quite a long time, because you'd fly up behind the position, so not to give away the fact you were there, and then you have to walk up to them to find them. And I never warned them I was coming, because I didn't believe that CEOs and people should hang around waiting for me. And if the CEO was out doing the same thing, then I took potluck with whoever was there. So that bought up a good slice of the day, bearing in mind it started getting dark again about 4. And I used to carry a little Norwegian patrol pack with my duvet in it, in case I spent and got my duvet jacket in case I got benighted, and some emergency rations, water bottle, torch, and all the usual good things.
Personal survival kit.
I carried a pistol, and I had other bits of stuff, you know, my maps, binoculars, all that sort of thing. my Norwegian head over and things like that. And then I'd come back before first light, before last light, and then bring myself up to date on what had been going on, perhaps discuss the patrol program, because I instituted a patrol master system. Once we were sort of forward in a brigade position overlooking the Argentines, I wanted to coordinate the patrolling so that we didn't leave any gaps and we didn't have any clashes. And so Hector Gullen, who was this chap who I talked about before, was a very experienced soldier. I made the brigade patrol master, and he went around finding out what patrols were being sent out, and also saying the commander wants that looked at and that looked at, superimposed on top of what the CEOs were.
What were the sort of patrols were these? Were they recce patrols,
both.
Security patrols, fighting patrols?
They were recce patrols and fighting patrols.
Uh-huh.
And the recce patrols were doing just that, and the fighting patrols were out there to sort of duff the enemy up and dominate no man's land and cause casualties to the enemy.
What strength would you put into a fighting patrol normally?
About half a platoon, half a troop, 15 men, or maybe a whole troop sometimes, with an FOO. So that they could, you know, use artillery fire, and an MFC, so they could use artillery and mortar fire to get themselves out of trouble or inflict casualties on the enemy when they were observing them. And recce patrols also were able to bring down artillery fire, because one of the things I think I said was that on the way south we trained every single man to call for and adjust artillery fire.
What sort of positions were these guys in when you were on this holding phase? Were they dug in?
Our chaps were dug in to the degree that you can never dig in the Falklands, because as soon as you start digging in, it fills up with water.
Yeah.
So they built sangers of peat and rocks, and they were sort of low breastworks. That's all they were, effectively. Because if you dug a hole, it just filled with water. You just stand in water all the time.
These one man or two man?
Two men, at least. Often four. Mm. And they were bloody unpleasant. I mean, they lived in those from the moment we arrived on the 21st of May through till the 14th of June. Mm. And so their feet were continually wet. Mm. They were continually wet. Then at night they'd be patrolling, and in daytime they'd be lying in these things, sometimes under shell fire from the enemy. Mm.
Did you suffer any casualties due to foot rot or other?
Yeah. Yes. Oh yes, yeah. Quite a lot. Yeah. Of not foot rot, of trench foot, which is a cold related disease, condition.
Mm.
We had a lot of those, and people stayed on, and one or two of the worst ones had to be pulled out, and a lot of them, you know, got cold injuries to this day as a result of it. We did a survey when we got back of people, and an enormous number of people had permanent injury to their feet as a result of cold injuries.
So you could sense the atmosphere, see the positions and so forth, and at the end of the day you got back, before last light.
Before last light.
What would you do when you got back?
Well, as I say, I'd talk to the patrol master, find out that he'd been round.
What he's doing.
Talk to the intelligence guys, because everyone was out, or tended, not everyone, that's an exaggeration, but the intelligence guys would be out talking to their opposite numbers, the patrol master would be out, the logisticians would want a session with me. To talk about the logistic plans, how things were going, how the ammunition stocking was going. So it was a time of sort of bringing oneself up to speed with what was going on. Then there was sort of evening stand too. And then I would usually go back to my vehicle, and we made a practice of all eating our supper together, because it was a sort of family occasion. My group, my wagon crew, and they would brew up whatever it was that was in the pack, the sort of dehydrated stew and perhaps a bit of this and that.
Who did that? Was there one person who was the designated chef, or did it circulate
around? It changed around. And I remember one of the things Jeremy Moore asked was anything he'd like me to bring out with him. So I said a Stilton cheese. So when he arrived, he brought out a whole Stilton. And I gave some of it, I think possibly half, to my gunner to have with, because he used to eat with his wagon. You could hear the two sort of families chattering away in adjoining CPs over supper. And I thought, this cheese will last forever. Last one meal.
Yes.
And that was it, gone. Well,
anything slightly different, if you're on rations, just go.
Absolutely, it's just gone. And then I would go back to the CP and... because there was quite a lot of planning to be done at night, and I would normally turn in probably at about midnight or just before, and I would when I went back to my grot, I would find that one of them would be awake if he wasn't on the radio, and would brew up a quick mug of hot water. I'd have my shave then.
Before retiring?
Before going to bed, so that I was properly shaved the next morning, but I hadn't got a shave early in the morning.
Go out midnight dancing, isn't it?
Exactly.
That sort of shaving.
Exactly. So I had a shave to tie myself. I would take my boots off, change my socks, if I had a dry pair, put my wet pair inside my combat jacket, which I then put back on again, powder my feet, very important. Put my shoes and I hope dry socks back on again, put my boots and dry socks back on again, because I went to bed in my boots. I would then get into my sleeping bag, take my pistol out and stick it under my pillow, but attach it by its lanyard to my wrist, and go to sleep.
Where was your sleeping bag? Was it in the vehicle? Or
no, it was, that sort of penthouse I showed you at the back.
The canvas shelter.
Yeah, it was on the ground.
On the ground.
Yeah. And the back. So the way we slept was that I had an LO too, an LOG. It was rather like an ADC. I'd forgotten him.
Yeah.
James Montefiore.
Yeah.
So my wagon crew was him, the batman, the radio operator driver, who was one chap. My bodyguard and me, so there's five of us.
Did you have any trouble sleeping?
No. I used to go to sleep listening to the naval gunfire support harassing fire, which you could hear through, even though if you were sort of 10 miles away from where it was falling, because of the peat, the sound travelled through the peat, like a railway line.
Has anyone done a study of peat acoustics?
I don't know, but you could hear, you could lie there, and you could hear doom, doom. And you knew that it was artillery fire, falling on enemy positions. And you think, well, I hope they're sleeping well tonight, and turn over and go to sleep. And then be woken up the next morning.
Now, you said that you could look at the Argentinian position. And you've described the British position, the Pete Sangers. What sort of positions are the Argentinians?
Well, they had peat sangers and holes in the ground, rather like ours, actually, and when we arrived up there. They'd had longer to prepare them, and they had used, because of the positions that they occupied, were on these, what I call dinosaur spine backs. There were a lot of positions where you could adapt a fissure between two huge slabs of rock by putting more things over the top of it, turn it into a pillbox or turn it into a sort of rock walled slip trench with a roof over the top.
Yes.
And they've done quite a lot of that.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm going forward a bit of the story because there's a bit in between, but when we got forward to positions where we could see where they were, I'd go up pretty nearly every day up to an OP and look and see what the hell was going on from our dock, and also to familiarise myself with the ground.
Did
and you could see them standing about on their positions sometimes, and they'd be standing about.
They're grandstanding or what?
They were grandstanding, and usually, if you felt you could spare a bit, you know, the temptation was to mallet them with artillery. But of course, you were having to bring up ammunition, but occasionally they were being too bloody blatant about it. So you'd say, you know, I'd say to my gunner, you know, mallet that lot, and he'd bring down, you know, about two rounds per gun, fire for effect on
a military stonk.
A military stonk, and they'd all scuttle back into their holes. I mean, do you want to talk about how we got up to that position?
Well,
or do you want to go on with routine?
Well, routine, if there is any more about routine. And, you know, the day-to-day life of the commander.
Yeah, I mean, that was really... If there was... and the other things, of course, one did in the day-to-day life was before any big event, there'd be an O group.
Yes.
And this was done very much... In the traditional style. And I always remember David Chandler, who joined my brigade by being parachuted into the sea and picked up and brought forward to take over from H, coming to my O group, and afterwards I think I overheard him, or he said it to someone, that was a real proper Camberley job. And I felt, right, well, you know, got it right. And I mean, an O group, for example, they would arrive and the helicopters would be sent away, and we had such a good camouflage headquarters, I mean, they couldn't find it sometimes, even from the air. They'd come and they couldn't see it, and they would arrive and they'd be met by the Prevost, the Royal Marine Police, and taken to the briefing tent. We had a briefing tent, and the BM laid on sort of soup and biscuits for them, because some of them, you know, they'd be flying and they were cold and that sort of thing, so welcome. They'd usually bring perhaps their signals officer and in IO with them, and they would be led away by their opposite numbers in the headquarters and given, you know, the latest codes, the latest intelligence, and then told, you know, when the O group's over, come back and see us if they've got any questions, anything we can do for you. Perhaps their QM would appear and be talking to my logistics staff. And the idea was to sort of get a lot of business out of the way, and then there'd be the formal O group, which was done in the proper way, with
going through the stages,
and we would issue for any major thing. I'd issue confirmatory notes. I can show you a copy of those if you like.
Who did those? Was that your brigade major?
Brigade major,
You would do the intention, and he would then put it into orders form.
That's right, exactly. Yeah. And we'd then go through the group. Would there be any questions? There weren't usually many. And then they would disperse and chat amongst each other and have another cup of tea. And it was an occasion for COs to get together and sort of talk over things. And, you know, it was a sort of business come social event, which was useful. So that was O groups. And sometimes I'd be summoned back to divisional headquarters in Fearless, which meant flying back sort of 40 miles, and it was an 80-mile round trip by helicopter, so it took a while.
Yes, it was.
And we'd have sort of little powwows there. So there was never any time for sort of hanging about. There was plenty to do all the time, and usually not enough time to do it all in.
You were saying that you know, you go to your CP in the evening, and you got back and you do planning, and you know, when you were there. How did you do that planning? Was that simply done in your own head, standing in front of the map, or was it a matter of chewing things over with your brigade major and your other staff?
I chewed it over with my BM and very much my gunner, who's a good chap to bounce ideas off. And we would either sit in the back of not my bandwagon that I lived in, but in the bandwagon in the CP, I'd sit in the back there with my gunner and the BM, or we'd sit round the map and just talk it through.
Was that when you did most of your thinking? Was that in the evening?
Yes, and of course when one was travelling around, you could do quite a lot of thinking as well. I mean, sometimes it was fine and not pissing rain. We'd sit in a rock outside in the daytime and chat away.
You were saying that, you know, you were building up a logistics base, forward logistics base at Teal Inlet. How long did it take before you were organised to sustain another movement forward?
Well, it took
the base in Teal.
We were ready by I think it was more or less the 8th of June.
Yeah.
The actual attack was launched on the 11th. The reason that we were delayed was because 5 Brigade weren't up, so we were waiting for them, effectively. I mean, the sort of stages in which it happened is having got as far as Teal Inlet, I then flew forward and spoke to Hugh and said, keep going now. And then by that time, 4-5 had arrived, so Teal was absolutely bulging with troops. And I then told 4-5 to move on as well the next day. So that left my brigade headquarters in Teal. Plus odds and sods, by which time the build-up was starting in there, so the logistics guys were starting to move a forward brigade maintenance area in there. I had a forward dressing station put in there as well, as a sort of splinter from the main one back at, to keep my medics close up behind, because I was getting too far away now from my medics. And I always remember what James Hill used to say on battlefield tours. You know what I mean by James Hill?
Indeed.
James used to say, have your medics as close up behind you as you possibly can. And James's words rang in my ears.
He had personal reasons for thinking of that.
Yes, he did. Yeah. And then the headquarters then moved forward. And because we couldn't drive the headquarters, we could drive the bandwagons across, because we had two headquarters. My second headquarters, because of lack of shipping, and because most of the bandwagons were still in Norway, was wheeled. You couldn't drive the wheel. So the wheeled headquarters had to come round by LSL and set up at Teal. Then we could move into it by helicopter. Then the bandwagons joined us and went forward to the next place.
So it's a leapfrogging.
The leapfrogging exercise, you see. So we had to pause at Teal. Now, Teal was actually very civilised, because the state manager had a lovely big, for Falkland Islands standards, wooden house. I mean, rather like a suburban house in, you know, Fulham. Only made of wood. Two stories, which is unusual. And we took over his drawing room as the brigade CP, while the wheeled headquarters was arriving, so I didn't want to sort of wait for it all. And then I slept on the floor of his dining room, on the carpet, with my sleeping bag and my gunner alongside me, the other side of the grand piano. And he was a nice man. He used to come round with big jugs of tea for the chaps in the headquarters every morning. And his wife used to cook lovely rock buns, which we the privileged few were given to put in our knapsacks for the day's rations. So we had a quite luxurious, that was, you know, a time of great comfort at Teal, about two, three days. And then we moved forward, by which time, and I'd rather skip this bit, 4-2 commander did a big leap forward by helicopter at the same time as the three para arrived at Teal Inlet. That night, or the next night, 4-2 commander did a big leap forward using the Chinook, the one surviving Chinook, and other helicopters, and seized Mount Kent, which was being held by...
That was the SAS base.
The SAS base.
Yes.
And they flew into the landing zone, which was secured by the SAS, and the they arrived on the top of Mount Kent, from where they could see Stanley, the objective. And I joined them there the next day, it was a great moment to walk up there and see the objective at last. You know, this place which we've been looking on in air photographs and photographs of for weeks, here it was at last.
What were the Argentines doing? Had they?
What had happened was they'd never held Mount Kent, curiously enough. I don't know why. Mm. I think they had second thoughts about that, because they actually decided to start holding it just as 4-2 Commando were arriving by helicopters. What happened was, the first night 4-2 Commando tried, they were turned back by a blizzard. Mm. And we nearly lost the Chinook, because in the blizzard it touched the water in Teal Inlet, I think, probably, on its way back, and scooped up a great bucket load of water but kept flying. Anyway, the next night they flew in one company plus three guns plus some mortars plus TAC HQ. And at that moment, this is when the Argentine Special Forces decided, I think, to come onto Mount Kent, and they ran into the SAS patrol, who duffed them up and sent them on their way rejoicing, which made nonsense of the remark that the task force commander made to me when I said, I'm trying to get recce onto Mount Kent, and he said, you don't need recce. Don't need recce, what a ridiculous statement. Mm. But to go up there at last and see the objective was absolutely terrific. I mean, we were then slightly chastened when they brought down 155 shells on us as we were sculling around on top. We were doing a bit of grandstanding
they'd
as well.
Spotted you,
they spotted us. Mm. They were pretty good at that. Their artillery was good. Mm. Then the very key thing happened. The chaps on top of Mount Kent, who I think were K Company of 4-2 Command, noticed some Argentines near the bottom sculling around. And so they sent a patrol down to grab them, and they found this was the rear party of the two companies that had been flown to Goose Green.
What were they doing?
Well, they'd been left there, you see, in charge of the big packs. In charge of.
And they hadn't been recovered?
No. No, it was typical Argentines. You know, they'd been there for a week and no one had done anything about it.
Sounds a bit slack.
Yeah. What was even slacker was the CP had a very interesting map in it, which showed the layout of the Argentine defensive positions for the first time.
So it was a two-company force headquarters.
It's a two-company force headquarters, but they had the layout of the whole.
And you've got the archives.
We got the archive. We had the layout in Stanley. At last, we had the layout of where everyone was, just about. I mean, almost down to company level. And certainly, you know, they had the layout of the radars and things like that. And that was a terrific coup.
It sounds like the best bit of intelligence gathering.
Best bit of intelligence we ever had. And then began this long period of patrolling, you know, 11 days worth of patrolling to find out what the hell the enemy were up to and where they all were.
And when you were patrolling, with your reconnaissance patrolling and your combat patrolling, were the Argentinians counter-patrolling?
No.
They weren't?
No. Mm. No, we didn't have one patrol.
No combat?
No, that's not quite true. They had little sort of rather pathetic patrols that would go and investigate things that they thought were suspicious. For example, a recce patrol that was sent out from 4-2 Commander to find a mine-free route round the back of the Mount Harriet, having had a pretty nasty time when a chap trod on a mine and blew his foot off. He then had to be casuvaged, and then the patrol went on. And I think the noise of the mine or something caused the enemy to be suspicious and send an investigative patrol, which is the only way I can describe it, down to find out what was going on. Bumped into this other patrol. Spotted it. And so this other patrol went to ground and just lay there and watched them. And I think perhaps the Argentine patrol either wasn't quite sure what they'd seen, because they were calling out in Spanish, and you know, they weren't quite sure of themselves. Anyway, they lay there for about an hour in the sleet and snow, and then eventually the patience of the Argentine patrol cracked, and they went back to their position, which, as the patrol commander said later, was brilliant, because he was able, through his night sight, to see where they went back. Mm. So he then, as he in his own words, knew where to look in this sort of hill. And then on the hour, all the sentries changed.
Every single sentry on the same hour?
Yep. And so he was able to see, and they sort of got out of their trenches and changed over, and so he was able to pick out at last and to know where to look and scan. And he brought back a bloody good report on that. And then the next night, or the night after, Nick Bork sent him out again to find a route right round the back, which he did. And this was an occasion where, again, good training came in. It was only, there was only a four-man patrol. And he realised...